From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. More and more states are looking at opioid taxes as they address the ongoing epidemic linked to these powerful drugs. A representative of Americans for Tax Reform shares his concerns. The head of the North Carolina General Assembly's Program Evaluation Division discusses his interest in setting new performance measures for government programs. The head of the new Free Trade Initiative at the National Taxpayers Union rebuts some popular trade myths. Plus, you'll learn why some policymakers have concerns about the chemical Gen X, and they have nothing to do with the Cape Fear River. Those topics are just ahead. First, Donna Martinez joins us with the Carolina Journal headline.
A new study on the effects of pre-kindergarten on achievement and behavior is turning conventional wisdom on its head. Joining us to explain the study results from Vanderbilt University researchers is Dr. Terry Stoops. He is Vice President for Research, also the Director of Education Studies for the John Locke Foundation. Terry, welcome back.
Thank you.
I think, Terry, if you ask the average person on the street about pre-K programs, they'll say, well, of course, every kid should be going to pre-kindergarten. After all, we want them to be fully ready for school and for first grade. Why have we all kind of come to that conclusion?
Well, because we believe that more schooling is always better. And that's really the problem here is that, you know, it's not so much that we have programs in place for these kids for K-12. But the thinking is that, well, okay, we got them at kindergarten. So maybe if we got them a little bit earlier, we would get them more of what they need, which is schooling, which is preparation for reading and math, because that really is the concern. Are they coming into kindergarten prepared for the curriculum that awaits for them? And so that is simply the idea that we have is that more is better. Just, you know, very similar to the debate we have about spending, right? Spending more on education is always better, according to some people. And we have the same sort of thinking here that more education is better.
Now we have this new study from Vanderbilt to researchers that really is questioning all of that with some very serious data. Tell us about the study.
Well, this is a data of that has addressing Tennessee's voluntary pre-K program. And what makes this study particularly interesting is that they randomly assigned students to two groups. One group who attend a pre-K funded by the state and one group that does not. And this is really the most important aspect of the study. We think about what a clinical trial is, for example, in the pharmaceutical industry. If you want to know whether some sort of medicine is working, you give a placebo to some patients and you give the medicine to others. And then when you have those two groups, you compare them to see how these groups fare, one against the other. It's the same idea here, except we're looking at social science research, and this is pre-kindergarten, and it found that not only do students, when they start getting into first, second, and third grade, not do as well as their counterparts, but in some measures, they're actually doing worse than those who did not attend a state-funded pre-K program in Tennessee. And that's a shocking finding to a lot of people who think that any time a student receives any sort of state-funded pre-K program, that they are going to see results and benefits throughout their education, not just in those initial grades.
Terry, what's different to me about these study results is that previously, we have heard of studies, and I think you and I have talked about them on this program, that were showing that kids would show some improvement in pre-K in the first couple of years of school, but then it really leveled off and those benefits went away. But you're saying this study is showing that not only do they go away, that there's a negative effect?
Yeah, according to these researchers, that on some measures, academic measures and behavioral measures, there was actually an adverse effect to being exposed to a pre-K program. Now, what we're referring to is the fade-out effect, and that's the term used for those who go through a preschool or pre-kindergarten program and by third grade don't have any of the benefits, don't show any of the benefits from having received that education. Now, this flies in the face of some very popular research out there, especially by James Heckman of the University of Chicago, who tried to track students who've received pre-K services throughout their adult life and find lower levels of incarceration and those sorts of measures, higher levels of employment. So that has been the prevailing idea, is that pre-K effects persist not only through one's education but into their later adult life. And I think that this study is sort of not only just questioning that but is part of an emerging body of research that's calling all of that into question.
What is the application then for North Carolina? After all, this is a study out of Tennessee about Tennessee's pre-K program.
Well, this really should get our policymakers thinking about their recent expansions of our pre-K program. We have over 30,000 kids currently in the pre-K program. We spend hundreds of millions of dollars, both in state and federal funds, on our pre-K programs, whether that be NC Pre-K and Head Start and all the various programs that we have for preschoolers in North Carolina, which really amount to a lot. I mean, the programs that we provide are expansive and expensive. And so we should be thinking about what programs are we providing? How much are these programs costing? And are we receiving lasting benefits from this investment? We should be looking at this study and thinking, is this happening in North Carolina? And then we should find out.
What would we do next, Terry? Because I would imagine when legislators and particularly education advocates and analysts hear about this and listen to our interview and look at the study themselves, they will be, I would say, at least surprised, in some cases shocked by this. Is that going to perhaps impede any analytical look at North Carolina's programs, because people might just think this can't possibly be true?
It's possible, but I think this is really the opportunity that we have, is to see, is this Tennessee program something that is being faced in other states? Are we seeing similar results in North Carolina? Why don't we try to do the same sort of research that they did in Tennessee to see if we get the same results? Now, I know that there are some people that are afraid of what we would find and afraid that we would zero out our pre-K programs. I don't think there's any intent to do that. I still think that pre-kindergarten programs for poor children and for children that are neglected or that have family lives that render them in dire circumstances, I think the pre-kindergarten programs for that cohort of students is absolutely critical. I think we need to continue to provide high-quality programs for those children. What we need to question, though, is should we be providing programs for students that are not in those situations? You know, we hear a lot of states talking about universal pre-K. That would extend pre-K to state-funded pre-K to middle-class kids. We have a lot of research that tells us that middle-class kids don't benefit very much from state-funded pre-K. And so my concern is that as we spend more money on pre-K programs and as we start reaching populations that don't necessarily show the benefits of pre-K, that it's an opportunity lost and money that's not well spent.
Your comments, Terry, remind me of some of the discussions we've had about the issue of class size. And you've always made the point that one size fits all is not the way to go. And in terms of class size, it could be that there are some kids or some grades that might need a smaller class, but in other cases that there's no benefit there. It sounds like almost that same analysis needs to take place here.
That's right, and we need to really start thinking about the individual circumstances of these children, because there are certainly times where it's absolutely necessary for these children, especially if they have a poor home life, which is where the foundations for their education are laid. If their home life precludes them from having the skills, the very basic skills necessary to be successful in kindergarten and in school, that the state step in and say, we will provide this for you. But once we start getting away from that population, I fear that it's not money well invested. And unfortunately, this is an issue that tugs at heartstrings. So when we talk about research like this, all too often it's, well, you just don't like kids, or, you know, this research isn't really getting to what kids really need. Let's take the research seriously. Let's take the needs of kids seriously.
We're talking with Dr. Terry Stoops. He is Vice President for Research, the Director of Education Studies for the John Locke Foundation. Terry, thank you.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment.
Government plays a key role in your life, affecting your paycheck, the way you educate your kids, the way you do business. How can you tell if government is doing a good job, making the right choices, spending tax dollars wisely? CarolinaJournal.com tackles those questions every day. The John Locke Foundation publishes Carolina Journal in print each month and on the web each day at CarolinaJournal.com. You'll find exclusive investigative reports on topics no one else is covering. What else? A rundown of the best news stories, editorials, and opinion columns in North Carolina. John Hood's Daily Journal. News stories and important public events at CarolinaJournal.tv. And the voices of the newsmakers themselves at Carolina Journal Radio. In print, on the air, and on the web, you can find the information you need at CarolinaJournal.com. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Headlines frequently warn us about the dangers of an opioid epidemic in the United States. Our next guest joins us to share a different warning related to opioids. Patrick Gleason is Vice President of State Affairs for the group Americans for Tax Reform. Welcome back to the program, Patrick.
Delighted to be with you, Mitch.
So your warning isn't to do with the dangers of the drug itself, but the prospect of taxation linked to opioids. Tell us about it.
Yeah, well, it's the latest tax fad, Mitch. So for decades, the go-to tax hike targets have been alcohol and tobacco. But starting about a decade ago, we saw state lawmakers get more creative with their go-to targets, and they moved from so-called sin taxes on tobacco and booze as their targets to other things like soda and snack foods. Well, they have a new target now. There's a new fad tax for 2018, and it's tax on opioids, a special opioid tax. We've seen about a dozen states introduce it. It's been introduced under the auspices of this is going to address the opioid addiction crisis. But our organization has come out against that because we disagree with that contention.
So basically, would this work like what have been traditionally called the sin taxes, where you've seen a special tax on cigarettes or alcohol? There would actually be a tax on all those pills of opioids?
Yeah, so it would. And it would be, in most proposals, it would be applied at the manufacturer level. Though, as with most taxes, these eventually are passed along the cost to consumers. And just to highlight that, in fact, was Governor Andrew Cuomo in New York just made New York the first state to enact a special opioid tax. They did this last month when Governor Cuomo signed the bill into law. And Governor Cuomo was speaking out of both sides of his mouth. He was a champion of the special tax. He was saying this will not be passed along to consumers and result in a regressive tax increase as we were contending it would. Yet at the same time, his own budget document, the section on that tax, said this cost will be passed along. So he admitted it in his budget document, even though he would not admit in public statements, that this regressive tax increase is ultimately passed along. And I would contend, though, the opioid addiction crisis is a serious issue that it very much needs to be addressed and has ravaged a number of communities across the country. But I would contend, and my organization, Americans for Tax Reform, contends a special tax on opioids is not the solution. In fact, addicts, by definition, are among the least price-sensitive actors in a market. So these will not address the opioid addiction crisis. They do serve as distractions from real solutions. And at the end of the day, they have negative unintended consequences in the form of a regressive tax hike.
Is this seen as the potential for a large money grab, or is it more the sense that, you know, people are mad about these opioids and this is a way that we could get at least a little bit of extra money out of them?
Well, that's how these opioid tax proposals and this new trend shares a lot of things in common with previous tax fads on things I mentioned, like soda and snack food taxes or bag taxes. It's a new tax that's sold under the auspices of doing some form of good, some altruistic cause, cleaning up the environment, making people healthier, when, as is the case with those punitive regressive Pigouvian tax increases, they don't improve health, they don't make the environment cleaner, but all they really do is they serve as an altruistic guise for a money cash grab. And it's no different with these opioid tax proposals. They're shameless cash grabs introduced and advanced under the guise of an addiction mitigation model. And what we are arguing to lawmakers is, one, they don't address or mitigate addiction, and two, this is just a shameless cash grab passed under a disguise. So that's what we see.
That is the voice of Patrick Gleason. He is Vice President of State Affairs for the group Americans for Tax Reform. You mentioned New York is the first state mm-hmm. that has actually enacted, mm-hmm. Enacted this. Tell us how it works there.
Yeah, so it's applied at the manufacturer level. This was introduced early in the year. Actually, Cuomo came out, and this was a proposal that he championed. In some states, we've seen this introduced in the legislature, but in New York, Cuomo championed this. And actually, this actually ties into a common theme we're seeing in a host of other tax proposals, and which is, I would call it taxing tragedy. In response to various tragedies, whether they're mass shootings or, in this case, opioid addiction crisis, which is tearing communities apart, the response from too many politicians and interest groups has been a new spending program or a new tax, when those don't get at the root causes of these problems, which often cases are behavioral. Whether it's an opioid tax, it doesn't get at addiction, or it's a bag tax, it doesn't reduce the environment. The problem is behavioral. There are more root causes that need to be gotten at. And this knee-jerk reaction to introduce a tax or a new spending program in response to tragedy is unfortunately too prevalent. We've seen it with gun tax proposals, both nationally in Congress, in states like California, and again, opioid taxes, bag taxes, soda taxes. They do not address the problem they are intended or sold under as addressing. That's the problem.
Now, one of the things that you often hear in debates is sort of the simple argument that if you want more of something, you subsidize it, and if you want less of something, you tax it. I'm guessing that some of the people pushing for the opioid tax are using that sort of simple formulation, but what you're telling us is you need to think beyond that simple argument mm-hmm. and look at whether this is actually dealing with the problem, and it isn't.
Yeah, and I would also like to mention one unintended negative consequence of these opioid taxes, and these have dire budgetary implications for states, is states, through Medicaid programs, which is the cost or share between states and the federal government, states are large purchasers of opioids. So a state like New York, when they institute an opioid tax, the state was actually taxing itself, since they will be paying that tax as one of the largest buyers of pharmaceuticals, including opioids. So among the many reasons, the fact that it doesn't address addiction, the fact that it results in a regressive tax increase, it would also have the state taxing itself. So just one of the many reasons why lawmakers should reject an opioid tax proposal should it be introduced in Raleigh or another state capital.
And you just mentioned Raleigh. We should point out, because most of our listeners are in North Carolina, that this is not something that we've seen yet really gain any kind of traction in North Carolina. But if someone within the General Assembly hears this and says, hey, this is a great idea, I'd like to put forward this proposal for an opioid tax, what would you tell them?
I would want to have a meeting with them so I could spend more time walking them through why it's a bad idea. I would let them know I'd be coming to testify against it. But I would say this is not the solution to the opioid addiction crisis. This will have other negative unintended consequences in addition to not addressing the problem. And again, this is a distraction from the real solution. So the closest state to introduce one to North Carolina has been Tennessee. Lawmakers there wisely rejected it in adjourned session without passing it. I recommend lawmakers in North Carolina do the same should it be introduced here.
You mentioned that this fits in with somewhat of a pattern. We've seen sin taxes for years and years, but you've mentioned, in addition to the traditional alcohol and cigarette taxes, things like soda and bag taxes and things of that sort. Do you suspect, given what you've seen in recent years, we're likely to see more of these types of things in the future? Something looks bad to some legislators, so let's have a new tax focusing on that item.
Yes, I do expect that, and for the reason the reason it's always been the case, the old Huey Long saying, don't tax you, don't tax me, tax the man behind the tree. That is the go-to strategy for politicians who want to increase taxes. So they always want to raise the tax on the others, some maligned population, some unpopular activity. So certainly it's the path of least resistance to raising taxes for politicians. So I expect to see the strategy continue.
We mentioned that New York has passed this, and I think you said a dozen states have at least talked about it. Is it likely that any other states at this point are going to move forward, or are you having success so far fighting back against an opioid tax?
Yeah, so I mentioned New York was the first and so far only state to enact one. The Republican-controlled Kentucky House of Representatives was actually the first legislative chamber to enact one about a month ago, though the state Senate there and Governor Matt Bevin rejected it. There are a few threats, bills still pending out there that could pass that our organization is watching.
One person who's going to be watching this very closely as these proposed opioid taxes are presented is Patrick Gleason, Vice President of State Affairs for the group Americans for Tax Reform. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Mitch.
We'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups across North Carolina all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. It's one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, opinion pieces and reports on higher education from the James G. Martin Center for Academic Renewal, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Try it today.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation, and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation, and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal.
Did you know you can now advance freedom and free markets just by shopping with Amazon? It's true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate us, the Locke Foundation, to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop and Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. So here's how it works. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile, it's the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible purchases to us, the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate the Locke Foundation as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today. Buy something nice and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. North Carolina's occupational licensing boards might have to do more in the future to justify their existence. John Turcotte of the General Assembly's Program Evaluation Division explains.
We had originally thought that we could start developing performance measures for the boards and have the performance measures put in place fairly early. Well, the consensus of the working group was that that was a bit too ambitious. The boards have not been required to keep consistent performance measures outside of the statistics that they've been compiling, which are not the same thing as performance measures. But members, I'm going to come before you one of these days and recommend that they do, that they are, they will be required to do performance measures. And for the boards that are listening in and their representatives, what it would be, determine what is the problem that you're trying to solve by regulating the profession. What is the problem? What is the public safety problem? There's some deleterious condition out there, some negative condition that if it was not dealt with by regulation of the occupation, it would continue to be too high and harmful to the public, or it would get worse. Okay? What is that problem? Not that what we're doing here, the problem is we have to comply with the law. Well, the law is not the problem. The law is the means to an end. So the end is, how are you dealing with this problem? And you should start thinking about a problem statement. And along with that, an outcome measure, and that is, okay, there is a problem there. You've articulated that quite well. Put some numbers around it. How big is the problem? How many people are impacted or affected or harmed? And as a result of your regulation, and as a result of your intervention as an occupational licensing board, what has happened to that condition? Is it going down as you would hope? Is it staying the same, or is it getting worse? Okay, how much worse? And so that's the outcome measure. And the easier measures are what we call output measures. That's like, how many people have you licensed? How many licenses have you turned down? The final measures would be efficiency measures, where you would determine what the different activities of the boards cost, and then you divide the outputs into the cost, and you get a unit cost.
That's John Turcotte of the North Carolina General Assembly's Program Evaluation Division. He's explaining new performance measures for state occupational licensing boards. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
We're doubling down on freedom. At Carolina Journal Radio, we're proud to bring you stories that impact your life and your wallet. And now, get twice as much freedom when you also listen to our podcast, Headlock, available on iTunes and at johnlock.org/podcast. Now, Headlock is a little bit different. It's a no-holds-barred discussion that challenges soft-headed ideas from the left and the right. But like Carolina Journal Radio, Headlock is smart and timely. But with Headlock, you'll hear more about the culture wars, and you'll get some more humor as well. We guarantee great information and a good time. Double down with us, listen to Carolina Journal Radio each week, and listen to Headlock, too. Remember, you can listen to Headlock at johnlock.org/podcast, or subscribe or download each week at iTunes. Carolina Journal Radio and Headlock, just what you need to stay informed and stay entertained. Both brought to you in the name of freedom by the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Today's political debates feature a lot of myths involving trade. During a recent visit to Raleigh, Brian Riley of the National Taxpayers Union helped rebut some of those myths.
When I talk about trade policy to people, a lot of times there are a couple of points that I like to try and get out to have people think about trade maybe differently than the way it's typically described in the press or by politicians. And the first is, I'll have different examples, and the example I use for me is my microwave oven broke this last week. So I'm flying back to D.C. tonight, and tomorrow I'm going to go to Target or Walmart or Best Buy or somewhere and buy a new microwave oven. So my question is, when I go buy this microwave and spend $100 or $150, I don't know how much microwaves cost now at Target, let's say, which one of us wins and which one of us loses in that transaction? Well, it's a silly question, isn't it? Because I win because I need a microwave, I get a microwave. Target wins because they've got a microwave to sell and they have sold the microwave. Trade is a win-win transaction. That's true when Brian goes to buy a microwave. That's true when Kroger goes to buy asparagus in the middle of winter from growers in Mexico. It's true when U.S. farmers in Kansas or Iowa sell soybeans to China. They're all win-win transactions. So thinking about trade as one person wins and one loses, I think, can lead to some policies that are harmful.
Riley offered another example about a myth involving trade.
If I take my big fat National Taxpayers Union salary, and in addition to buying a microwave this weekend, I buy a new Ferrari that's made in Italy, and I send them $600,000 and I get the car, I have just added $600,000 to the U.S.-Italy trade deficit, or to the overall U.S. trade deficit with the world. How much do any of you owe Italy because Brian just added $600,000 to the trade deficit? Nothing. The answer is zero. Trade deficit is, if I could change one thing, it would be for the government and for policy wonks like myself just to stop using the phrase trade deficit, instead saying net exports or trade imbalance or something like that. Then we could have a nice discussion about who has unfair trade barriers and what can we do about it and how can we address it. But when you use the phrase trade deficit, any normal person who hears deficit is going to think we're losing or money's being deficit drained out of the U.S. economy. And again, this leads to some very wrong policies that are bad for the United States.
That's Brian Riley of the National Taxpayers Union. After spelling out the examples of the microwave and the high-dollar Italian sports car, Riley recapped his basic message.
Trade is win-win, and trade deficit does not mean dollars are being drained from the U.S. economy. And if you're with me and you agree with that and you understand it, you know more than the U.S. Commerce Secretary, the U.S. Trade Representative, the Chief Trade Advisor to the President of the United States. And I say that sometimes people laugh or they're in shock. But if you look at the comments, it's all based on the trade deficit's too bad, we're losing. If they really believe that, they don't have an understanding of how things work. And I stress if they really believe it, because I don't know how much politicians typically believe what they say or they're using it to get at other topics.
Riley leads the National Taxpayers Union's Free Trade Initiative.
Just describing what free trade means to us, it just means when you earn your paychecks, you get to decide how to spend the money, and somebody in D.C. doesn't get to decide how to spend the money. Free trade agreements that remove barriers, that increase economic freedom, and a lot of times I talk about trade in a vacuum, but policies are all interrelated. I mentioned trade deficits, as much as I said, I hate that phrase, but what it overlooks is the money that people earn in other countries when they sell something to us. If they don't buy our exports, they invest in the United States. They build Toyota factories or they build Kia factories. That benefits us. Politicians rarely focus on that. Over 7 million Americans work for companies around the country like Toyota, Kia, many here in North Carolina as well. If you have a dollar to invest, whether you're sitting in North Carolina or Kansas or Iowa or China or Mexico, the U.S. is a pretty darn good place to invest that money. So a lot of money that might otherwise be used by U.S. exports is invested in our economy or is borrowed by the federal government. We run a big budget deficit. How are we going to finance the overspending if we're not taxing? We have to borrow it. We borrow it from Americans, or we borrow it from Europe. We borrow it from Japan. We borrow it from China. So dollars that could have been used to buy American exports are essentially spent on U.S. Treasury bonds instead. So this does not mean that other countries, particularly China, aren't guilty of bad acts that we ought to try to do something about. But let's not make the mistake of blaming other countries for policies that a lot of times are really made in the USA.
There's a lot of talk in political circles about renegotiating the North American Free Trade Agreement, or NAFTA. Riley offers some historical perspective.
It originated with President Reagan's 1979 campaign announcement when he said, I want to have a common accord between the three North American countries where goods will flow more freely between the three countries, just like they flow between the 50 states. That's the direction I think that we should head with respect to NAFTA. And I think it's been something that has benefited the U.S. tremendously. Look, if you're worried about China, No one would be more happy to see the U.S. pull out of NAFTA than the leaders in China. We risk falling behind as other countries move forward with trade agreements if we don't continue, not just either, at least if we don't expand our agreements with other countries, we sure shouldn't be pulling out of them. Manufacturing output in the U.S. is up like $1 trillion since NAFTA was passed, not all because of NAFTA, but it added to economic growth in the United States and encouraged other countries around the world to pursue similar trade liberalization. And I don't know how many people here are concerned about immigration, but I've talked to a lot of groups, and it's a big concern. If you can imagine a scenario that we have today where the leading presidential candidate in Mexico is somebody who's praised Fidel Castro, who's compared U.S. investors in Mexico to pirates, and you marry that with the U.S. potentially pulling out of NAFTA, well, do you think we have an immigration problem now? You have no idea compared to what we're going to have down the road. NAFTA has been a win-win. Wages are up in all three countries. It should be improved. It should be modernized.
That's Brian Riley, director of the Free Trade Initiative at the National Taxpayers Union. He defended free trade during a recent presentation in Raleigh. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
A commitment to truth and transparency in government. That is the mission of Carolina Journal, and we are proud to deliver. And now, proud to tell you, the North Carolina Press Association has honored two members of our team with awards for reporting and writing. That's right, we really do deliver award-winning journalism. We shine the light on government spending, reveal the truth about boondoggles, and dig deep into programs paid for with your tax money. We keep you in the know in a way other media outlets don't. And our reach and influence are growing. Through all of our outlets, we reach more than 1 million North Carolinians each month. So make sure you're one of them. Our monthly print edition arrives in your mailbox every month. Our online daily news site, CarolinaJournal.com, has fresh stories, opinion pieces, and more. The award-winning Carolina Journal team, our reporters make government accountable to you. Call 1-866-JLF-INFO for your free subscription. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. The state of North Carolina, and other folks as well, have sued a chemical manufacturer for releasing Gen X into the Cape Fear River, contaminating drinking supplies. But now, Carolina Journal has learned that Gen X also is present in some solar panels. Dan Way is associate editor of Carolina Journal. He's been following this developing story and joins us now. Dan, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Donna.
What is Gen X?
Gen X is a chemical compound. It's in a class of substances known as emerging contaminants. So there's not a lot of things known about them scientifically. It's subject of a lot of research right now.
But yet the word is contaminant, so that definitely has a negative connotation. Is this something that's dangerous, or is that the subject of all of this controversy?
Well, that's part of what's going on with the lawsuits, whether it is dangerous or not. And certainly at this point, there has not been an established toxicity level where there's a safe amount. The state has come out and said 140 parts per trillion in water is the maximum level, but there hasn't really been anything from the EPA on the federal level yet.
You were writing this story, Dan. It's really pretty interesting because there's been a lot of reporting statewide about Gen X and the deposits into the Cape Fear River. But how did you determine, or how did you find out that this chemical also is in some solar panels?
Well, that's good sourcing.
Because you're a great reporter, right? Okay, I know you can't reveal exactly who, but...
And that's what intrigued me about the story, that there are some people who are raising some very legitimate concerns about EPA and the groundwater system. And given the history of this compound, they're right to ask the questions. But there are also a lot of people running around with their hair on fire about this, you know, thinking this is the big environmental story of the day. And yet no one was looking at the fact that, from publicly available information, you can find out that Gen X is used in the process for developing Teflon film.
Which goes on to some solar panels.
They build – that's a coating that goes on to the panels to help in the generation of the electricity. It magnifies and improves that.
I think one of the reasons that your story is getting so much attention is because when you say solar panels, Dan, I mean, are we talking about everything from something that we might put on our own house, on our roof, to like a major solar farm?
Well, there are various types of film coating that are used, so it wouldn't be on every solar panel, every solar cell. It would certainly be possible that it would be in these Teflon films. In Chemours, the folks who make this chemical and use it in the process for developing solar panels film, from their own marketing materials, it definitely says that it's used in the process. So when you're talking about 140 parts per trillion in groundwater, I don't know what that would translate to in a solar panel, but no one's doing that research. No one seems to care about whether or not there might be a big Gen X problem out there. And it has been showing up in other parts of the state that are not at the plant.
Oh, it has. Tell us about that.
Well, there's not a lot known about that yet. Gen X is also used in commercial products, so things you would have in your house, anything that would have Teflon.
Like pots and pans and
skillets. And so there's just not been a lot of a big body of research on Gen X itself at this point.
What does the company, the manufacturer, have to say about all this? You mentioned their marketing materials. One would presume, considering that we have how many would describe as a robust regulatory system in this country, one would presume that if they're using something in production that it has been reviewed by some sort of official agency or scientific folks.
Yeah, well, DuPont, which originally owned the plant, the Fayetteville Works plant, didn't comment at all. They have divested to Chemours and set up Chemours as an independent company. So they wouldn't answer any of my questions. They referred me back to Chemours, who did not respond to numerous requests for information and interviews. So didn't get much from them. They did send me some information updating the lawsuit that the state has against them for the discharge down in the Cape Fear River, but nothing about the solar panels.
What about regulatory agencies like the federal EPA or the State Department of Environmental Quality?
Well, the federal EPA, they did confirm to me that Gen X is used in solar panels. So that was a tough get. You know, there hadn't been a lot of folks who've been able to substantiate that. They're doing testing right now. Chemours and DuPont have been under a consent order to do testing since 2009. There was a lot known from the DuPont plant in Parkersburg, West Virginia, where they were making Teflon. And they used a previous version of Gen X, which was C8, it was called. And that was found to cause testicular and kidney cancer, hypertension, some other illnesses. And they ended up settling that with about 3,500 claimants for $670 million. So we do know that precursor was dangerous, and there are health scientists who are saying that they're seeing some similar activity going on with the limited amount of evidence that's available right now on Gen X. So it's a new strain, a new version of the old substance, but it is raising some concerns among environmental health folks.
Is it raising any concerns among state policymakers?
Well, DEQ, which you would think would have a big interest in this, I sent them a list of questions at their request. I didn't get any responses yet. I filed a Freedom of Information Act to get some information that they have not responded to. There were identical bills introduced in the House and the Senate earlier this year by Republican lawmakers in which the bill had passed would have authorized the governor to shut down Chemours if it didn't reduce its discharge of Gen X into the Cape Fear. And yet none of them but one responded to me when I asked them about whether they had any concerns with the Gen X and the solar panels or not. Deb Butler, who's a Democratic lawmaker from New Hanover County, raise a lot of concerns about Gen X, but said she didn't know anything about the solar panel relationship. Richard Hudson up in Congress, he's been hot on this. He's had discussions with the previous EPA administrator, Scott Pruitt, about it. So there are some folks who are asking.
Dan, let's talk a little bit about the solar industry in North Carolina, because this state has gotten a lot of attention for the proliferation and the growth of the solar industry. Is that one of the reasons, first of all, that you got interested in this? And number two, why are we such a big solar state?
Yeah, well, exactly. That's one of the big drivers of my interest in this story is we have the second largest amount of solar capacity, installed solar capacity in the country, behind only California. So if we have all these solar panels out there, some of which may or may not contain Gen X, it would seem to me that
that would raise
some concern, especially if, as some of the opponents are saying, the critics are saying, it's so dangerous. Why would we not want to know just as much about what's going on in the solar panels as we do with the discharge at the plant?
Why such a big solar industry? I'm from Arizona. You can understand it there. You could understand Florida, North Carolina, a mid-Atlantic state. Why?
Subsidies. It's all about the subsidies. We've had very favorable terms and conditions and programs for the solar industry to flourish here. So
where there is money, people will follow.
It's like the
That's
old
exactly
field
what
dreams.
You've been
you
reporting
it, they'll
on.
Come, sort of.
We've been talking with Dan Way. He is associate editor of Carolina Journal. More questions over Gen X, that chemical, as it relates to potentially being included in some of the Teflon used on some of these types of solar panels. You can read it all at CarolinaJournal.com. Dan, thank you.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have for the program this week. Thank you for listening. On behalf of my co-host, Mitch Kokai, I'm Donna Martinez. Hope you'll join us again next week for another edition of Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.